Welcome to 1 Hour Sale, a conversation with Steely Dan featuring songs from their new album, Everything Must Go, available as of June 10th, 2003. Everything Must Go is Steely Dan's 9th studio album, only their 2nd studio album in the last quarter century, and their first since 2000's Two Against Nature, which earned them 4 Grammys, including one for Album of the Year. I'm Jody Denberg, and I am in Santa Monica with Walter Becker and Donald Fagan of Steely Dan. Gentlemen, I know you are East Coast natives, but Steely Dan formed here in L.A. Where do you make your homes now?
Well, I still live in New York. We were out here from 71 to 78 making the Steely Dan albums that were on ABC Records. Came out here in 71 from New York and moved back in 78.
Well, I've sort of split my time between New York and Hawaii at this point.
And the record was recorded in New York, the new album.
A little bit in Hawaii, but almost all in New York.
Did your location affect the writing or recording of Everything Must Go?
I don't think so. I think we have a kind of a Steely Dan room in our minds where these things are conceived. The only thing that made this one different maybe was that 9/11 happened during the recording of this album.
So much of Everything Must Go was recorded live to analog tape, which is, I guess, a different way of working for Steely Dan. Why did you go that route?
Well, we found ourselves working in a studio other than our usual studio, and it was a little place that called Sear Sound that we discovered after we got there had once been the Hit Factory, where Donald and I had worked on an album back in 1969 or 1970. Anyway, it was still sort of an old style studio, small control room, same tight acoustic treatment in the playing room, and a great little tracking room. And they didn't have any digital machines. They had a lot of great old vintage mics and tube equipment and analog machines, and we just started working on these analog machines, and we loved the way it sounded.
The new album is full of grooves. I mean, there's these deep musical grooves on it. It seems like it would take forever to get them in the pocket when you're recording live.
Well, actually, we got lucky. We started working with this drummer that we discovered. He played on Two Against Nature on a cut. And his name is Keith Carlock. Everything we threw at him, he was able to pick up on really quick. So by the end of the day or sooner, we'd have a track. He was just a great groove drummer. And he's also unusual in that he's a great groove drummer. He's also a very good jazz drummer as well. So he's got both the jazz technique and, you know, the happening backbeat.
Who were some of the other main musical mensches who were involved on Everything Must Go?
I like that main musical mensches thing. You know, I'm gonna use that myself later tonight at dinner or something. I think part of the reason we had as much success getting things happening was we had a whole rhythm section. We had a 6-guy band, 2 guitar players, 2 keyboard players, bass and drums, that where everybody really felt things the same way and was able to, you know, get on the same wavelength and really define rhythmic parts and come up with cool parts and all that. And so the other guys in the band, Donald played keyboards, of course, and I played bass. John Harrington played guitar. Hugh McCracken played guitar. John had we'd played with before, we'd toured with and recorded with before, and of course Hugh we've been recording with since the 70s. And Ted Baker was the 2nd keyboard player, great musician that we played with on our last tour and on the last album.
So much of Everything Must Go seems to address the current state of affairs here in the U.S. of A. Was there a point after the last album when the two of you got together to brainstorm where you were going lyrically with Everything Must Go, or were these just the songs that poured out?
As I recall, we did talk about certain kind of thematic things that we were going to write about before we started writing the songs, but they had nothing to do with the things that actually happened in the country. They were more sort of personal themes or motivations for the characters in the songs or backstories for the characters of the songs. And I think that to some extent the preoccupation, if there is one, with social order is just is more a product of a sort of our growing fascination and horror at what we see around us and what's happening in the world and so on.
So many times the lyrics to Steely Dan songs are like puzzles that could have different solutions. Does it bug you when people ask you what the songs are about?
Well, I think it's kind of defeating for us to just give any explanation of the songs, because I think part of what makes them interesting is associations that they spring in the listener's mind. But, you know, we certainly have something in mind when we write them that's, you know, maybe specific, although sometimes I'm not sure if we even get down to the real details. You know, there are songs, we're not writing a novel or a film, so we don't have to know everything about a character, and we don't have to know everything about the situation the character's in, but we have a general idea. But I think that the listeners, generally speaking, even if they get something else from the song than that we intended, it's usually pretty close, especially as to the feeling of it.
Well, the song that opens the album is The Last Mall, and it seems like the beginning of the end. Are we sure the beginning of the end of what?
Well, but it's a very swinging beginning of the end. It's a hard grooving, hard rocking beginning of the end, you know, and I think that matters as much as anything, don't you? If we're going to go, let's go out rocking. That's what I say.
Apocalypse Wow.